This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibb. You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now, here's Night Call host, Russ Gibb.
Hello, Night People. This is Gibb. Standing by in Washington, D.C. is attorney Ronald Goldfarb. Now, Mr. Goldfarb graduated from the Yale Law School and then served 3 years in the United States Air Force. In 1964, Mr. Goldfarb practiced law as a special prosecutor for the Organized Crime and Racketeering Section of the Department of Justice. He also served as a member of the President's Task Force for the War Against Poverty. And later in 1964 was a special writer on Robert F. Kennedy's staff for the New York senatorial campaign. In November, Mr. Goldfarb's new book, Ransom, a critique of the American bail system, was published by Harper & Row. In Ransom, he speaks out against the profound social injustice of the American bail system. If you'd like to comment on the present American bail system, or share with us any experiences that you've had with the workings of the bail system, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, our national Night Call number is area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make that call station to station. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our operators are on duty, our lines are open on Night Call, and we invite you to join us here. Area code 313-846-6601. And remember, you may reverse the charges. Mr. Goldfarb, what is bail?
System that our law uses to govern what happens to a person from the time he officially comes in contact with the law, that is from the time he is perhaps arrested in a criminal case or indicted or arraigned, until the time months later when he is tried. It's a system which, as many of our legal institutions, we have adopted from the English. Many centuries ago, if I can give you a bit of history, the judges in England traveled throughout the realm, often didn't get to a place for many months. The prisons were deplorable, and they were also very insecure. And so the sheriffs, who had the responsibility of seeing that a defendant was around when the judge finally came to town, was happy to pass on this responsibility to an employer or a friend or a family of the person charged with the crime. And if they would vouch for the fact that he would be present and appear at the time the judge came for trial, he was happy to allow them to take over control of that defendant. There's only one purpose of bail, and that is to assure the appearance of a defendant at his trial.
What does bail actually mean, B-A-I-L?
Bail is where someone or something is in the control of another person.
I see.
Under our bail system, in effect, the defendant is under the control of either the court or someone who will vouch for him until the time that he shows up for trial. Now, our system has, although adopted from the English, has been made one significant change, and that is that we have changed from the personal vouching of one person for another to a money element. That is, the bail bondsman will now vouch that a person will be present for trial, and he'll stake a sum of money that the person will be there.
This sounds like gambling.
Well, it is. In a way, it's something like insurance. Instead of really assuring the presence of a person, as was the rule originally, he now promises that he'll pay a stipulated amount if the person isn't there, the idea being that this money inducement will bring the bondsman to assure that person's presence at trial.
Actually, the bondsman, then, has to keep his eye on the fellow that gets the bail, is that it?
Yes, the bondsman really has the singular role in these first steps of trial.
Well, now, in your book, you criticize the American bail system.
Yes, you got the point.
I can't help it, right on the front cover there, a critique of the American bail system.
Yes, I feel, Russ, that the system as it operates in America is scandalous. I could break down for you into some categories about the four reasons that strike me as reasons why our system is insufferable and ought to be changed. For example, any system which bases a man's freedom before he's convicted of any crime upon money inherently will discriminate against a large amount of people who simply don't have that money to buy their freedom. And so we find that many people suffer periods of time in jail for the crime of poverty. And as one justice on our Supreme Court said, a system of law which bases the kind of justice a man gets upon how much money he has is not good. Well, our bail system, in effect, does that. Secondly, it has been proven through the years that the bail system has lent itself to excessive and what I feel are inexcusable abuses. That is, it's such a discretionary kind of open-end power that judges have been allowed to use it for ulterior purposes. As I stated in the beginning, the purpose of bail is to assure a man's presence for trial. And yet, time and again, judges will use it to punish unpopular defendants, or to teach a lesson, or to give someone a taste of jail, to break crime waves, oftentimes for right purposes, but really powers beyond which they ought to be using it.
Our guest tonight is Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author, and we're talking about reforming the American bail system. If you'd like to join us here at Night Call, our number is area code 313-846-6601. Ron, you mentioned that money is the key word here in the American bail system. Was it always so?
No. Originally, as I stated, the idea was to have somebody just assume the responsibility of assuring a man's presence. But that has changed with the addition of the money element, so that the spreading out of responsibility to people who would ordinarily be likely to assure someone's presence, such as his clergy or his employer or his family, somebody like that, has been relegated to the bondsman. And the bondsman really is has become a partner of sorts of the judges and the police with regard to pretrial procedures. I feel that this partnership is somewhat of an unholy alliance, and one which our experience has shown has worked to frequently compromise the administration of justice.
Well, now, what happens to a fella that can't afford a bondsman? What do bondsmen cost? I mean, how does this work?
Well, a bond is usually 5 to 10% of the bail itself. For example, if the judge sets bail in a case at $1,000, a bondsman will go bond, it's said, for a man if he will pay a premium of let us say $50 or $100. Then the bondsman will require that man put up collateral for the full, to the extent of the full $1,000 in case he should skip. The bondsman would be responsible to the court for the full $1,000.
All right, he makes his profit this way. But what happens to the guy that can't afford?
The guy who can't afford it, in a word, simply goes to jail. And this is not a very small amount of people we're talking about.
How many?
It's been estimated, Russ, that over 1.5 million people go to jail each year in America because they don't have the money to afford a bail bond.
1.5 million Americans.
Yes, and 10 to 12 million people buy bonds, it's been estimated. So we're talking about $250 million a year business, and we're talking about an inherent discrimination against a vast part of the people in this country.
Is this why we read of the racketeers running around before a trial, or people that are famous leaving the courtroom immediately because they can afford bonds?
This is the other side of the coin, Russ. On the one hand, the requirement of money bail will discriminate against people who don't have it or can't afford it or aren't known in town and therefore a bad risk, so to speak, and keep them in jail when really there's no risk of their not appearing for trial and they should be free. The other side of that coin is that there are an awful lot of people who present specific dangers to society, aside from whether or not they'll appear for trial. Those people ordinarily can afford bail, and so I feel that the bail system fails with regard to them as well, because on the one hand it's keeping in good-risk people in jail for no reason other than the fact that they're poor. On the other hand, it isn't taking into consideration that society may have grounds to protect itself against people who would endanger it pathological criminals, organized crime, and
in other words,
racketeers, they can afford a bail bond very simply and be on the streets. So being able to afford the money for a bail bond is irrelevant, both to the poor man, who may not be any risk at all, and to the racketeer, who, if he's going to present a danger to society, well, we don't want him free, even if he can afford it.
Ron, every once in a while I'll read in the paper, though, where a judge will say, will not allow a bond to be set for an individual. Can they do this?
Well, legally, most states and the federal government the laws say that in capital cases, a judge may set bail, and in all other cases, he shall set bail. That means it's discretionary in capital cases, and it isn't in other cases.
Now you're talking like a lawyer again. Capital means death?
Right. Where it's a murder or a very serious crime where there's a death penalty, then the judge has the discretion not to. But in other cases, he's supposed to set bail. What judges will do then to get around this, Russ, is set bail extraordinarily high, knowing full well that the man isn't going to be able to afford it, and thus accomplishing their purpose of keeping him confined if he presents some kind of a danger. But really, this is a kind of manipulation, and sympathize as you may with the problem the judge has, he's really abusing his powers if he sets an excessive bail. Constitution says bail should not be excessive. And so if a judge sets it at $100,000, meaning to keep the man in jail, although it's hard to prove and hard legally to do anything about it, he's really setting excessive bail. Then there's another interesting question, and that is, what if a man is just very poor? Perhaps $100 bail is excessive to him.
Well, how does the judge know this?
What does excessive mean?
Yeah, that's a relative term.
Can't be excessive, but we're living in a society where we know from recent studies of poverty in this country that a quarter of our population fall below the poverty line. And so the idea of excessiveness really, I think, should be reconsidered in light of that.
Are these the people then that are usually involved in crime too? I mean, that segment of the economy?
Well, I think that they have the great problems. You find that crime rates are high in poor areas, but again, when we're talking about bail, we're talking about a point in time when the man has not been tried yet. And we presume, our whole philosophy and our system of law is that we presume that a man isn't guilty until he is convicted. And yet, we are punishing these poor people before they're convicted.
We put them in jail.
By putting them in jail. And what is more shocking, if that isn't bad enough, is that recent studies have shown that people who have compared the fates of people who were in jail before trial with those who were free on bail before trial, and found out that those in jail before trial are convicted more, plead guilty more, sentenced to jail more, so that one's status before trial seems to follow him throughout the trial process. And I can add that this isn't only a problem of the poor, hapless guy who happens to end up in jail. The cost of running this bail system to you and I and to the taxpayers in all the towns that are listening in tonight are staggeringly high. One judge, for example, in New York City pointed out recently that I believe it was in 1962, 58,000 defendants were in jail before they were tried because they couldn't afford bail.
In New York City?
They spent, in one city alone, they spent 1,700,000 days there, and it cost the city over $10 million to pay for these facilities. And this is so in, perhaps not to this degree, but in all the major cities of the country, we, the taxpayers, are paying to house these people, to feed them, to maintain them. We're using up our police, who might be better used elsewhere to serve custodial functions here. So we're all paying a tremendous price for it.
Our guest tonight is Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author of a new book on the bail system in America called Ransom, and we're talking about reforming the American bail system. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Look, I'm quite self-sufficient. I made myself what I am, thank you.
But don't you think all of us occasionally could use a little divine or...
Gee, I gotta run. Here's my card, anyhow. I'm a vice president now.
Well, good.
Yes, indeed.
But your name, it's just penciled in here.
Well, there's a big turnover in personnel. You know how it is.
Uh-huh. Well, that's just about how it is in life, isn't it?
Pardon?
We're all just penciled in.
Where'd you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it could be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by the United Presbyterian Church.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb. Hello again, Night People, and we're looking tonight at Ransom, a new book on the American bail system by Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. And Ron is in Washington and on Night Call tonight. He's also an attorney as well as a author. So if you'd like to comment about the American bail system or ask a question of Mr. Goldfarb, give us a call here at Night Call. Now remember, you may call us direct. You may dial area code 313-846-6601 and reverse the charges if you wish. Now that's area code 313-846-6601. If you get a busy signal on the Night Call lines, just hang up and dial us again. Our operators are on duty and we invite you to join us here tonight and let's hear what you've been thinking about in regards to the American bail system. Should we keep the present system or should we try for a new system? Well, let's hear what you're thinking about. Area code 313-846-6601. Mr. Goldfarb, I have a caller standing by in Indianapolis, Indiana. The gentleman is listening on WFBM, Mr. Rick Shepherd. Good evening, Rick. Welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please.
Thank you. Bail required in out-of-state, say, JP courts for minor violations like traffic, speeding, little things like this. I know in crossing the country several times that especially in some of the western states, this is the case where you're required to post quite high bail when they know that you are not going to return or will not return for such a minor offense.
Rick, have you had that experience?
Yes.
Okay. Ron, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with Mr. Shepherd. This is probably one of the prime examples of what you might call a ransom. A lot of people would go farther and perhaps call it a shakedown. I think that it isn't only a bail problem. This is the whole problem of the justice of the peace and how it operates for out-of-staters. But I do think that it's wrong. I think that probably one of the answers would be to have a quicker trial, although I question what kind of trial it would be. I don't know the answer to it. I just feel that taking money from a person in this kind of a way is really wrong, and it's been terribly abused, and it's one of the kinds of problems that seem to strike home to a lot of people, because I know from other programs I've been on, a lot of people have had the same kind of experience as Mr. Shepherd, and it's one way possibly to bring home the kind of injustice on a larger scale that I talk about in my book, because it is a problem that isn't confined to the bad guys and the criminals someplace, but it is it's a system that hits us all and hits us in an unfortunate way.
Ron, let me ask you a question. Is it possible on a speeding violation, if you can't meet the bail, that you'd have to stay in jail for a month, did you say, before trial?
Well, I don't know that it necessarily necessarily be a month, but I can give you a perfect example of the kind of thing Mr. Shepard was talking about and the kind of thing that could happen to any of us. This was an example that was mentioned to me, as a matter of fact, by a gentleman who taped a radio show about the same book with me some time ago. When it was over, he said, you know, I'd like to tell you a story about Bale. And he told me the story about how he was at one point pulled in for reckless driving because a particular traffic light that he had gone through was broken at the time. And he and another man were arrested. This was a Friday, and they were brought before the local justice of the peace, something like Mr. Shepard's example, and they were charged with reckless driving, and bail was set at $200. Well, he paid a bondsman who appeared on the scene immediately, $20, I guess it was, and was told to show up in court the following Tuesday. Well, in the interim, he found out about the light being broken, and so when he went into court on Tuesday, he explained it to the judge, and the judge apologized for inconveniencing him and dismissed the charges. So as he was leaving, he said, you know, it kind of annoys me that they used up some of my time on Friday, and they dragged me into a police station, they made me take a half a day off on Tuesday, and it cost me $20 to boot. At which point the other man said to him, you're complaining, I've been in jail since Friday night. It turned out that this man had just moved to town, and he didn't have any friends or employer yet. His family was to join him, he had just shifted jobs. And so nobody would go bail for him because no one had any way of checking up on him. Well, this man stayed in jail from Friday night till Tuesday simply because of the silly requirements of bail in this case, a perfectly reputable person. And pretrial detention facilities are worse than some of the state penitentiaries. So it's a very horrible kind of experience for somebody to go through. And often the paying of money is not the worst.
Rick, do you have any suggestions on how we might reform the bail system?
Reform it? No, but I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
The time that I have in mind particularly happened in the state of Mexico.
I'm having trouble hearing, Russ.
Yeah, I'll try paraphrasing for you. It happened in the state of New Mexico?
Right. And though the bail was not exorbitant by any means, it was rather high. And when we were taken into court, there were several others who had been caught in the same radar setup as we had been caught in. And we were all told that unless we would like to spend, this was on a Friday evening too, about 1 o'clock in the morning, that unless we all wanted to spend the night in a jail with approximately 300 drunks, we were told, that we could pay our bonds and leave. And so, in other words, it was almost blackmail to get us, you know, out of the area. And we were right on the state line. And this, to me, is an injustice all around, admittedly. And as Mr. Goldfarb has said, it is widely known. So why hasn't something been done about it? Who can do something about it? Is it under any type of federal control? Is it all local? Is it state? Or where do control lie?
Ron?
Well, there has been the beginning of reform of the bail system, some aspects of the bail system around the country. A large number of cities are experimenting with different reform programs. The state of Illinois is. The federal courts in Detroit are doing a good job in this respect. In New York City, there's a reform program going on. Tulsa, Oklahoma, there's a program going on. They're essentially experimenting with ways to avoid the requirement of money and to find better ways to assure that a person will at the same time show up for trial. So there is a beginning. There's still a long way to go. Federal government has been holding hearings for the last 2 years at the United States Senate before the Judiciary Committee and some of its subcommittees for a new system which would reform all of the federal courts. Bail procedures. The essence of what most of these experimental programs are doing is taking the requirement of money out of the bail system, taking the bondsman out of the partnership with the courts, and placing upon the courts the obligation to determine at this pretrial stage whether or not a man has ties to the community, whether or not it's likely he's going to flee, and whether or not with with some supervision by the court, it would be a wise thing to release him on his own trust. Well, these programs so far have worked tremendously well. In one trial period in New York, for example, the people who were on bail jumped three times as many times or failed to show three times as much as people who were released on their own trust.
In other words, people are trustworthy then.
Right. And if they're not trustworthy, morally, practically speaking, we seem to have reached a point where it's just terribly difficult for somebody to flee. The average man has too many ties to the community. He has a family, he ordinarily has a house, he has a job, he has debts. Where is he going to go? He can't afford to stay away forever anyway. He can't emotionally leave his community. And in those few cases where people are fugitives, the FBI is pretty good at getting them back. So it's a fact of life that there really isn't too much risk of flight. And so if the only purpose of bail is to assure a man's appearance, some kind of investigation before at the time of his arraignment can disclose this, and then we can successfully deal with this on a much more responsible basis.
Rick, I want to thank you for calling Night Call and sharing your questions with us.
Thank you.
Good night, sir.
Good night.
Mr. Rick Shepherd, a gentleman from Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on WFBM, a gentleman who had an experience that I guess many of us have had, getting a ticket from a justice in a small town and then going to a justice of the peace. In some states, they're doing away with justices, aren't they?
With JP.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of reconsideration now of the role of the justice of the peace and the abuses. I think that probably remains there a good book for somebody to write.
Well, maybe that's the next one. Of course, I think you're going to have to do a lot of explaining yet on ransom, because I think you have quite a job ahead of you. If you, in the beginning of the book, you talk about why you wrote the book. And obviously you felt concerned that the American bail system is really in violation of the American Constitution, isn't it?
Yeah, the American Constitution and a lot of the principles that I think we all share that isn't necessarily specifically stated in the Constitution.
We're talking tonight with Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author, and he has written a new book called Ransom, A Critique of the American Bail System.
And it's a very, very interesting book, and a book that, well, makes you think and wonder a little bit about the American legal system, and particularly this problem of bail. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Well, I can't this Sunday. I'm playing golf, and the following Sunday I promise to take the kids to the beach.
Uh-huh.
Man's got to spend some time with his kids, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Besides, we seem to get along just fine without church. You know, it's up to the individual. Gee, look at the time. I got to run. But anyhow, we'll trot along to church one of these days.
Uh-huh. Well, how about 2 weeks from Sunday?
Oh, I never planned that far ahead. 2 weeks, the whole world could blow up by then.
That's right.
Where'd you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it could be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by your Council of Churches.
This is Night Call, and here is host Russ Gibb.
Hello again, night people. Our guest tonight is Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author. And we're talking about reforming the American bail system. Now, if you'd like to join us here in Night Call and express your opinion about the present bail system that we have going for us in this country, or if you'd like to tell us about some experiences that you've had with this system, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, it's very easy to call us. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, gentle people, you may call from anywhere, collect. You may reverse the charges if you wish. Now, please make that call station to station. Our night call number, area code 313-846-6601. Our lines are open now, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. Area code 313-846-6601. Mr. Goldfarb, let's go out to Topeka, Kansas. A gentleman who's listening on WIBW out in Topeka, Mr. George Randall. Good evening, George, and welcome to Night Call. Your comment, please, sir.
Well, how do you do?
Yes, sir.
I've wondered about this thing.
George, can you speak up a little bit?
They have set up in all organizations certain, like credit organizations and so forth, areas of credit. Now, there are certain... This is a boy in Alabama that got taken back there illegally and brought back to Pennsylvania. It develops now on the late night that he was also jumped bail bond in Pennsylvania on a revoked driving charge. Now, it seems to me that they could establish the respectability and the lack of any previous record with police records, immediately. I have never been arrested for any offense of any kind, and it seems to me that they could establish that, but it seems that they hold somebody in jail because he can't make bond, and they release others. It seems to me they could establish within a short period of time the respectability of someone on first offense, respectable third offense, and establish the respectability and reliability of certain people.
Well, George, let's ask Ron what the possibilities of this. Is it possible to establish the respectability of an individual?
Russ, I think Mr. Randall is quite... I think Mr. Randall is quite right, and as a matter of fact, not only can it be done, but it can be done cheaply. There's a group that started a reform bail program in New York City called the Vera Foundation, and they have, in essence, gotten an office outside of the courtroom, and in about a 20-minute period, they take these defendants before they appear before the court, ask them a series of questions related to their ties to the community. They score those questions and on the basis of that information make a recommendation to the court to release this man on his own trust. It's worked very well. It now has the cooperation of the district attorneys and the courts, and in fact the city administration is doing it themselves now. Moreover, the cost of doing something like this was calculated to be about $13 a person, while the cost of detaining a man in jail without something like this is $120 a person, so that the taxpayers have a tremendous saving, as well as the individuals who have been, to a great degree, released on their own trust and have provided no problem in terms of skipping.
So people are concerned about this problem, and...
There are, and the suggestion that Mr. Randall makes is entirely accurate, and I think it is the direction that should be taken.
Mr. Randall, I want to thank you for calling Night Call, sir. Mr. George Randall, a gentleman from Topeka, Kansas, who is listening on station WIBW out in Topeka. Let's go now to Mr. Dave Wells out in Littleton, Colorado, and the gentleman is listening on KTLN out of Denver. Good evening, David. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir. Your comment, please.
Yes, sir. I'm kind of provoked at the whole penal system.
Okay.
No, we've got a town here. I won't mention any names. We've got a town in Colorado very nearby Denver. And I've been quite concerned about the legal system up there, especially recently the bail system. There's a boy that... my wife and I have been quite interested in this small town. And he got some difficulty not too long ago. He was 17 years old and pilfering some buildings in the town area. And he was caught late one night. They threw him in jail. There was a family separation, so they kept him in jail for some time, pending the family separation to find out if things would get better so that they could release him to the custody of his parents. And when things did get better, they released him to his home. Then things got worse, so they took him back into the custody of the court again. Then they decided to release him to the custody of a, an unmarried woman, or separated from her husband, who had a boy his age, who was being involved in the same kind of situation that he was involved in court, out of court, back in again. And he was not supervised now in this house, not watched in any way, shape, or form. He was allowed to keep his own hours, had his own key to his own room in the basement of the house. And this was provided for by the court. Now, the court said, this is what we'll do. We feel that this is a very substantial situation. We'll go ahead and do this.
Well, was the boy out on bail at this time?
No. No, I'm approaching that now.
Okay.
I'm not trying to strand you. We don't feel I am. Leading up to this, anyway, the boy has had all of this freedom. And, again, this freedom was designated by the court that he should live with this woman and her son. And they didn't designate any hours for him or anything. And he was on probation at this time, and saw his probation officer once a week. And, well, I guess he'd cook up a little story every time he went in to make things look real nice and rosy. And my wife and I watched this, and we advised the court that we didn't think it was a good idea for the situation to be like this, and to have his custody placed in our hands down here in Denver, that we could watch him closer. But they said, oh, no, he's perfectly all right. Well, the situation developed that the boy started doing the same thing all over again with this other fellow, her son, apparently. And now it's developed to where he's gotten caught a second time. He's also turned 18 years old in the meantime, and now has spent Christmas, will spend New Year's, and it's already been about a two-week period of time now that he's spent in jail, because he's now of legal age to where he can be placed in jail and kept there on a $5,000 bail. And if you attempt to speak to the court in any way, shape, or form about this, well, the boy is bad, and this is exactly what he deserved.
Well, they're using bail.
Excuse me?
They're using bail here in a little different sense, aren't they, Ron?
Well, yeah. It sounds like they're using it in kind of teach a lesson. A lot of judges will want to give a juvenile, especially, a taste of what the inside of a jail looks like, and so he'll set bail so that it can't be made, and that way, without having any trial or anything, in effect, you're giving him a jail sentence. The Congressional Record some months ago had a statement in there by a congressman by the name of Mick Zicker from Colorado, who told a story about that took place in Adams County, Colorado. It involved a 21-year-old boy who had no criminal record and who was accused of assaulting an officer of the law. He was arrested, and they set bail at $10,000. Well, he couldn't afford this, so he was in prison for 8 months waiting trial. It subsequently developed that the policeman confessed that he had falsely accused the defendant, and he was then released. But in the meantime, this boy had spent his time, he'd lost his name, he'd been away from his family, been deprived of the ability to earn system, to earn a living, because the system was used in such a way to, in effect, imprison him because he couldn't afford the bail bond. The story that Mr. Littleton tells is one of, unfortunately, many where judges will use bail for a purpose completely disrelated to what bail is really designed for, which is, as I said and can't repeat too often, strictly to assure a man's presence at a trial, nothing more.
Dave, obviously you feel this is an injustice, then.
Yes, sir, I certainly do. I feel this, that the same court who indicated that he should be put in the situation that he was in Boulder, under the circumstances that he was in, living in a home where there was very little supervision, if any, and then to do something something like this, and it's all being the same court, it makes me feel that possibly their thinking comes a little bit late. Apparently, the thinking should have been done long ago. We offered them a good outlet. We said, let us take the boy with us, where he'll be in a home with other children, but yet he will be supervised, where there's a mother and a father, a continual three-square meal a day type program, where he must be here to eat this meal, and he must be here for this one, and for the following meal. He must go to bed at certain times, and he must get up at certain times. But there's no regulatory basis in the household he just left. Nothing's regulated at all. His room is never checked to even see if he spends time in it. And it would appear to me that now the thinking in the matter is being done now when it's all too late. Now the boy's facing probably 2 or 3 years in, I don't know what jail they put him in, to tell you the truth, but he's facing 2 or 3 years in jail.
Well, David, I want to thank you for calling Night Call and expressing your opinion and sharing the story about the youngster with us. Mr. David Wells from Littleton, Colorado, listening on KTLN out of Denver, Colorado. And our guest tonight is Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author, and his new book, Ransom. Let's go out to Montgomery, Alabama now. A gentleman who's listening on WFBM out of Indianapolis, Indiana, Mr. Steve Roberts. Good evening, Mr. Roberts. Speak right up, sir. You're on Night Call. Your comment, please.
In Alabama, you know, this is about, I heard someone mention on the radio that, about that boy who was returned here and said it wasn't right or something. Well, anyhow, in Alabama, we haven't got a law against that. And so I don't see why that if somebody, bail bondsman, puts up money for some person and then they leave the state. I mean, that's the bondsman's law. So instead, if they have to wait for red tape, like extradition papers or whatever it is, if they have to wait for that, well, they themselves, I don't see why they shouldn't be allowed to go up there. And this boy admitted, he himself said that they didn't treat him badly. I mean, it'd be different if they had strong-armed him or something. But they treated him nicely, so I don't see how that could be all that wrong.
But well, let's ask Mr. Goldfarb. He's a lawyer. Ron, what about this case?
Well, there's an article that I think is about to appear in the New York Times tomorrow. I was called about it today, so I am familiar with it. The objection is this. Aside from this particular case or what the factors were winding their coming up, just as a general principle, I find it objectionable that a bondsman has a governmental role, in essence, and moreover, that the bondsman's powers in this regard exceed the powers of the police with regard to arrest and extradition. Now, there have been many instances where bondsmen have used this power in rather gross ways, but even aside from that, the powers of arrest, the powers of taking somebody into custody and moving them through states, very responsible kinds of powers, and powers which, even in the hands of police, are carefully guarded under the system of law, and I think rightfully so. And yet the bondsman, who is not in any way an official of government, is subject to much less controls and has greater powers than law enforcement officers who exercise counterpart functions. He's acting, in effect, as a de facto agent of the state, and yet he's not subject to the safeguards that ordinarily surround the conduct of police officials for a state. It just strikes me that, aside from examples of brutality or overbearing conduct, which have at times come up when bondsmen have gone out to get people, it seems to me that the power to arrest a man with much less controls and much less judicial scrutiny than the police themselves have is one that I just don't think should be delegated around so loosely.
Steve?
I heard the argument, but I didn't hear the conclusion.
I see.
I just think it's too great a power to give to somebody who is not under the control of the law and is not someone trained in the law and someone responsible under the law.
Steve, do you think that any man should have the right to arrest another man?
Well, I think the citizen's arrest is certainly something that has a right to exist. And I can see where maybe a little bit, that point may be stretched as if in the circumstance like going all the way to Pennsylvania to take back someone who had left the state. But these people who put up the bond and then have someone leave the state, what assurance have they got that they're ever going to get their investment back? So,
I agree with Mr. Roberts to this extent. I think that it's unfair to put the complete criticism on the bondsman. I think that the fault is in the courts, that the courts should have the job of keeping custody of defendants until they're tried, and that they shouldn't delegate it out to bondsmen who are under no controls, who are subject to very few character and any kinds of qualifications or controls. I don't think it is a job we should delegate to them. Once we've delegated to them, then we have less to complain about when they go off and do this. Certainly, if the man has assumed an obligation to have another man show up for trial, you've got to expect that he's going to do some of these things.
Steve, I want to thank you for calling Night Call.
Okay.
Good night, sir. Mr. Steve Roberts, a gentleman from Montgomery, Alabama, listening on WFBM out of Indianapolis, Indiana. We're talking tonight
to Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and author of a new book on the American bail system called Ransom. You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Busy America. Busy America. Busy making money. Busy buying gadgets. Busy keeping up with you know who.
Is that your idea of fulfillment?
Don't you wonder if there's more to life than just that rat race with no finish line? Where'd you get the idea you could make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? It's a great life, but it could be greater. Why try and go it alone? The blessings you lose may be your own.
The preceding was presented by your Council of Churches.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
We're taking a look at the American legal system tonight on Night Call, and particularly the bail system. We have as our guest Mr. Ronald Goldfarb. He's an attorney and the author of a new book called Ransom, a critique of the American bail system. And if you'd like to comment on the American bail system or ask a question of Mr. Goldfarb, give us a call here at Night Call. Our Night Call lines are open, and you may call us by dialing area code 313-846-6601. And remember, you may reverse the charges. You may call collect. Area code 313-846-6601. We invite you to join us on Night Call. And Mr. Goldfarb, we have a caller standing by in Mesa, Arizona, a gentleman who's listening on KBUZ out in Phoenix, Arizona, Mr. Tom Jones. Good evening, Mr. Jones, and welcome to Night Call.
Your comment, please.
We were just sitting here talking about your show, and we were wondering about some of these people that are put on bail bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And for an instance, here in Phoenix, this happened just a while back, that a man was put on bail, it was in for robbery, and went out and killed somebody. On another incident. Now, are these bail bonds actually that good like that?
Ron, what do you think?
Well, this is a point that I do get into in this book, and I'm glad you raised it, because it deals with what I call in the beginning of the program the other side of the coin. Most people who have discussed bail, and especially those programs that have tried to reform the bail system,
I've dealt with the problem of the man who's in jail and who really should be out because there's no danger that he will flee. And so the argument goes, bail is irrelevant. If the man is going to show up for trial, he shouldn't have to put up money. The other side of the, what I call the other side of the coin is, what about the man who is a danger to society? Assume he will appear, as most racketeers will. Usually you can figure that they will show up for trial, and they can afford bail. I feel that in many of these cases, their ability to afford it is as irrelevant as the poor man's inability to afford it, as to what the consideration ought to be. And I do have a chapter of this in this book, in which very generally I suggest a procedure before the man is tried, where in certain kinds of cases, where it is it can be clearly shown that he would present some danger to society if he's free, that there would be a way to detain him before trial. Now, this does get us into very difficult constitutional questions as to imprisoning a man without a trial, and it could well be that a procedure like this is objectionable. However, I think that it could be designed in such a way as to avoid these constitutional objections and to, at the same time, give society the protection that I feel, and you may feel, it needs in certain kinds of cases. In my book, I suggest that that those cases would be the situation of the organized criminal, the situation of the pathological criminal, the situation of the cyclical professional criminal, the man who, whenever he's free, is simply going to commit more crimes. And I have cited some really wild examples of men who committed 8, 9, 10, 11 crimes while they were on bail on each of them before they were eventually tried. And also certain kinds of treason and sabotage cases. I do think that the whether or not a man can afford bail is irrelevant in these kinds of cases, and that there should be procedures to control them before trial. I might add that Senator Tidings of Maryland has made a statement that he is going to have hearings before one of the subcommittee that he chairs this session in Congress, and it may be that he will be persuaded that that legislation in this area is forthcoming. But if you were suggesting that there's a need there, I couldn't agree with you more.
Tom, I want to thank you for calling my call and expressing your opinion.
That's quite all right. Thank you very much.
Good night, sir. Mr. Tom Jones, a gentleman from Mesa, Arizona, who's listening on KBUZ out of Phoenix. And Ron, in your book, you brought up a problem on how the bail system is being used in the civil rights movement. Would you care to say a few words on that?
Yes, Russ. This is something that we have to draw our own conclusions from. Nobody can prove what it means, but I think that the message is clear that in certain kinds of cases where you're dealing with unpopular defendants or unpopular kinds of crimes, judges will use the bail system, whether it's subconsciously or consciously, in ways to prejudice those people, to make it hard on them, possibly to see that they go in jail, to punish them, in essence. My discussions with the lawyers who have been involved in the civil rights cases in the South over the last half dozen years, I have heard it said time and time again that bail has been used as a prime weapon to deter the civil rights demonstrations and to punish the demonstrators.
And actually, that was not the purpose at all, then, of bail originally.
Well, of course, bail is strictly to assure that they're going to show up for trial. In most of these cases, these people are trying to provoke litigation and want to get into court so that they can make their points in the court, figuring that they're not going to win them any other place. But although one would think that what has bail got to do with civil rights, it isn't related inherently, but it has become a very prime concern because it's been used in many places to bankrupt the civil rights organizations that are leading the demonstration. As one lawyer put it to me, they won't go into a town unless they've got a war chest because time and again, hundreds of people have been put into jail, and bail has been
particularly high. Bail bondsmen have been particularly absent in their assistance. All of the possibilities for making bail difficult have come about. And although, as I say, nobody can ever really prove in these cases why this is being done, it certainly seems that it's being done by whoever is in charge of setting bail, whether it's the police in some cases or prosecutors or...
Well, Ron, we have another caller, and I think we can take half time, about a minute and a half remaining for this caller.
Okay.
Let's jump out to Lewistown, Montana, Mr. Bill Belap, and he's listening on KXLO out in Lewistown. Hello, Bill. Speak right up. You're on Night Call. Your comment, please.
I might say that I sure appreciate your program, Mr. Gibb.
Thank you.
It's very stimulating and informative.
Well, you're very, very kind, Bill.
It continues for a long, long time. Now, I agree wholeheartedly a lot with your guest there about this bail situation. However, the main importance of my call, I had a question, which runs quite congruent, I think, to his subject here, and I'd like his answer if I could get it.
Well, we got about a minute and a half remaining. Bill?
Yes?
We have about a minute and a half.
Now, that's on this Fifth Amendment business. Now, I find this awful disturbing. When they invoke this, I see nothing in the Constitution that says any such statement. I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might incriminate me. It doesn't say anything about that at all.
Ron, does it or doesn't it?
Well, I think we read it differently. I sure think it does.
You what?
Ronald believes that it does.
Well, now, unless I've got the bum dope, it says, in these words, a person cannot be made to be a witness against himself.
Right.
That's what it says.
In essence, the statement, I refuse to answer on the grounds that it would incriminate me, means you can't make me be a witness against myself.
I can't hardly hear you.
I say it's arose by any other name. I think both of those statements mean the same thing.
Well, now... this could be true, yes. A matter of interpretation.
Historically, that's what it was intended to cover. It's quite clear, both historically, as far back as we can trace the Fifth Amendment.
It's quite clear from the time that
the constitutional framers wrote the Fifth Amendment.
Gentlemen, we don't have time to go into the Fifth Amendment now anymore on Night Call, so Bill, thank you for calling.
Yes, sir, and thank you for the opportunity.
Good night, sir.
Good luck.
Bill Belap from Lewistown, Montana, listening on KXLO. And Mr. Goldfarb, I want to thank you for being our guest on Night Call tonight.
Yes, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Certainly your book called Ransom is an excellent one, and I recommend it highly for anybody that's interested in the American bail system. Tomorrow night
on Night Call, our guest will be 17-year-old Barry Bezance. He's a high school student who recently made newspaper headlines across the country by being expelled for wearing a black armband mourning the dead of Vietnam. We'll be talking to Barry about how he views the world. Until then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station. As a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.